Good morning. I'm calling this meeting to order, House Committee on Revenue, Tuesday, May 7th. We're taking the agenda in a slightly different order. We will hear Senate Bill 262 first, and then we will go back to the top and take the remaining of the bills in order. Opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 262.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill or Senate Bill 262 is a sunset extension to January 1st, 2032. There's two programs at issue here. They are both housing programs. One program is a low income housing tax exemption and property tax exemption, and the other one is a property tax exemption for housing that sits in what are considered core areas. They might be near light rail or something like this. They are currently in statute and scheduled for sunset.
Thank you. I would like to call up Eric Knoll, Dory Van Bockel, and Ethan Nelson.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs, members of the committee. For the record, Eric Knoll with the City of Portland. Thank you for hearing this bill today. My role here this morning is to introduce the bill and then turn it over to my colleagues to provide more detail about Senate Bill 262. We know you have a busy agenda this morning, so we're going to be both thorough and expeditious in our panel. Senate Bill 262 extends the sunset of the multiple unit limited tax exemption, also known as the multi-program, for another 10 years to 2032. Cities and counties have the option to implement this program and provide up to a 10-year property tax exemption for qualifying multiple unit housing developments. The statute does not create a mandate for cities and counties, rather it creates an option providing local leaders with an important strategic public investment tool to advance housing and community goals. Property tax exemption programs like multi provide local jurisdictions and developers with a tool to incentivize the development of housing. And currently, the cities of Portland and Eugene implement this program. In Portland, multi is used as an incentive for the development of affordable housing, and just in the last 3 years, over 850 affordable units have been created under the program. This tax exemption is a key incentive used in conjunction with Portland's inclusionary housing program that contributes to a comprehensive approach to address the housing crisis. The multi is used to incentivize development and address the supply of affordable housing. Local jurisdictions, when assessing whether or not to implement this program, are weighing choices and costs very carefully. And ultimately, implementation of the program is subject to the concurrence of at least two different taxing jurisdictions that make up at least 51% of the tax base. Finally, local program requirements balance development goals with revenue impacts in assessing whether or not to implement the program. I want to address two quick points before I turn it over to my colleagues. First is that while this program is scheduled to sunset in 2020, we are coming forward in this session rather than in 2021, recognizing that this would provide more certainty and predictability for developers within the development cycle. And also note that the extension period for the multi-program is set at 10 years, and that's both historically been the case for this program and for housing tax abatement programs, again, providing more certainty and predictability over the long run for developers. This program was last reauthorized in the 2011 session for a 10-year period to 2022. And with that, I'll turn it over to my colleague at the City of Eugene to explain Eugene's implementation of the program.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, members of the committee. Ethan Nelson from the City of Eugene. And we are supportive of House Bill, or excuse me, Senate Bill 262. And in Eugene, it's, as Eric said, that MULTI, we call it the MUPTI. And so there's all these great acronyms that are out there for different tax exemption programs that cities are able to utilize to affect the types of development that our city councils and our community support. In case for Eugene, the MUPTI program, we've operated it since 1978. And we've had 28 residential developments since that time, creating about 1,500 units. And since at least 1990, all of our downtown market rate housing developments have used MUPTI. And so it's a really important tool for Eugene to be able to leverage private investment in our downtown core area. There's been about 9 projects in since 2019, or excuse me, 2017, and we've had those 9 properties would have generated, or excuse me, those 9 projects that we have supported have generated about $940,000 of taxes that have come back onto the tax rolls after the exemption is over. And those same 9 projects, had they not been developed, would only be producing about $74,000 on the tax rolls. So it's a very large way for us to leverage investment and get more property onto the tax rolls at a higher level. In 2015, City Council determined they wanted to take a break because of the some of the use of the MUPTI, and so there was a retooling. And out of that, we developed a review panel for each exemption request. And that review panel has members of our neighborhood associations and neighborhood groups, as well as technical consultants that come before and look at the project based upon its merits and its impact in the community. There's also required public benefit criteria within for the MUPTI application, and so that includes focusing in on compact urban development, green building features, and so we ensure building energy performance is above 10% above commercial code, local economic impact, and so that includes local support for local businesses, minority and women-owned business enterprises, and insurance compliance with all laws. Moderate income housing contribution, and so the project can either incorporate in moderate housing within their units, or they can pay on into a fund that then the city then utilizes for other types of affordable and moderate income projects in the community. And project design and compatibility, and so we look at scale, form, quality of the building, mixture of project elements, relationship to the street and surrounding uses, and parking and circulation. We also look at historic and existing housing sensitivity, and then, as always, there's a project need but-for clause. And so we are very supportive. We want to continue to be able to utilize this tool. It's been instrumental in redeveloping our downtown and other parts of our community, and we hope that you will support the bill. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson and the rest of the committee. My name is Dori Van Bockel, and I'm here with the City of Portland managing our program of the MULTI and other don't have a clicker, but that's okay. I just want to give a real quick description. Some of the stuff that Eric already mentioned described the program pretty well as to how it's implemented within the City of Portland. Again, eligible projects are proposed construction, any additions to existing structures, or conversion of existing non-residential properties to include new units of residential affordability. And locally, we utilize the program in partnership with Multnomah County in order to set the goals for the program, namely around affordability for the City of Portland. Each exemption is paired with the with the inclusionary housing program currently, and we do still take an approval for each application through City Council, ultimately for that public hearing and to allow for the review of each application individually. The program has been used within the City of Portland since the 70s when it first became enacted at the state. It's gone through many renditions, and as described by Eugene, we've also continuously, through our partnership with the county and information from the school districts and others, with periodic reviews of the program and setting of the goals, and consistently making sure that we're getting the most productivity out of the program based on the foregone revenue and how that's experienced across the jurisdictions. Most recently, the program has been used specifically with an affordability provision, as well as some requirements to have a disability, so ADA required units in the affordable units. And by being used specifically with the inclusionary housing program, any of the affordable units will exceed the 10-year tax exemption by remaining affordable for 99 years. So the affordable housing covenant that's included with inclusionary housing exceeds the tax exemption by that point. Part of that is due to our own but-for test based on the calibration of the inclusionary housing program, and the multi is a key incentive that we're able to provide to developers participating in the inclusionary housing program. Just an example of some of the units that have been, you know, approved recently within the pipeline through inclusionary housing across the city of Portland. So all of these will have affordability at either 60 or 80% of median family income for that 99-year period. So there's a huge need, even though a lot of our goals around housing are focused on meeting the deepest affordability level at the 30% or below of median family income, where their households are most vulnerable, but there's still a very significant need at the 60 or 80% of median family income. As you can see, there's at least 6,000 to 7,000 between 60 and 80% identified as in need at that income level of needing units, and a much greater need below the 60% of median family income. So this is just a quick snapshot of, you know, how the applications have varied over the last several years as programs have come and gone in different priorities, as well as how the market has ebbed and flowed a bit. And we're definitely seeing an increase in the usage of the program currently, and certainly continuing it through the next 10 years will be vital for us to continue with the helping to offset the changes in the market that we're experiencing already through increased construction costs and other impacts, so that we can keep some consistent development happening across the city of Portland. So thank you very much.
Questions? Rep. Smith-Warner.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you all for being here. Actually, if you could keep the slide up. Thank you for your presentation, Dory. Two things. Number one, I'm happy on this slide to see that the numbers are going back up even after inclusionary housing, because that was the boogeyman that we heard a lot about with inclusionary housing, that, you know, it'll bring development to a screeching halt. And it indeed slowed it down, it looks like, and it's on the rebound because the economy is the economy and there's still lots of incentives to do that. My question is actually on the slide before about the percentages of that 47,000 to 49,000 below 60% median family income. Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
That's means, just Portland?
Yes. And that means that people are paying more than a third of their income towards their housing.
Right. And then I guess I also just wanted to point out and see if you had any thoughts. And if folks are below 60% of MFI, I mean, they're going to have more needs than just housing. So getting them into stable housing is incredibly important, and that's only the first thing. You know, we've been talking a lot about education, about how in our schools, traumatized kids, education is the last thing we can do for them after we stabilize all of their other trauma, and this feels like that getting them into housing is a huge part of being able to do the other stuff. But it feels as though a lot of this need would end up having wraparound needs as well. I mean, I'm thinking about like the Bud Clark Commons and places like that that have other on-site provisions of services. So I'm not sure there's a question in there, but any comment you would care to make?
Thank you for the commentary, at least, Commissioner Warner, and to the chair and vice chairs. Certainly, this is one program and one form of providing affordable housing as part of the overall continuum. And so certainly there are other programs that are, like I said before, more focused on the deeper affordability, that like the permanent supportive housing funding that recently the city's made more efforts towards reaching, so that there are more wraparound services is to allow people to be more stable on their housing, to transition through the continuum, and allowing to, you know, continue to free up units as people improve their situations, ideally, and keep that stability. And certainly we see you know, a lot of families being able to use some of the inclusionary housing units. There was a provision added at council where they can have a few fewer units as long as they provide family size units in the developments. So we're actually seeing that as a provision that's being used a lot, particularly as projects in the central city are moving forward, which were the ones that took the longest break, kind of adjusting to the economics of inclusionary housing. And so that will provide an opportunity for families to live in some high opportunity areas across the city with good schools.
Yeah. Great, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Noel, you mentioned 850 units were created under the program, and I didn't catch the time frame. Is that within the last year or 10 years, or what was that?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, that's within the last 3 years.
Last 3 years, thank you. And follow-up, Mr. Nelson, you said 9 projects in 2017. What is 9 projects? How many units is that?
Chair Nathanson and Representative Reschke, I apologize. I was reading through my notes after I read them. I'm going to read them again and based upon what I submitted on the record. And so it was, we've got an over 20, or excuse me, 30 projects since 1978. And since that time, we've had 12 projects come back onto the tax rolls. By 2017.
Okay.
And out of those 12 projects, they've generated about $960,000 of property tax revenue to the city. And those properties, those 12 properties, had they not been improved, would have continued to provide $74,000. So my apologies. And
okay, just clarification. Thank you. And just one more follow-up. So I know this is being used in Portland and in Eugene. And I'm just questioning why it's not being used by developers in Bend or Redmond or Medford, where there are also housing affordability issues. Do you have any comment on that? You may not be the right people to ask that, but.
Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, thank you for your question. I will not offer conjectures to why other communities have not chosen this tool specifically. I will say that in ORS Chapter 307, there are a number of tax exemption programs available to cities that may meet other requirements, like 307-515, the low-income housing tax exemption program, or 307-540, the nonprofit housing tax exemption program, that are calibrated differently. This tool specifically, created in 1975, was meant to focus on downtown cores and transit-oriented development. And so for communities like Portland and Eugene, it became a more logical tool to provide incentives for the development of multiple unit housing, and particularly affordable multiple unit housing. But other tools are available to communities that may not have the same level of density or transit that may find a more useful function.
And one quick follow-up, if I may. All right, thank you. And by transit, do you mean light rail, or do you mean busing, or what's transit mean when you say that? What's that? Cable cars?
It's generally it's generally considered either by the light rail or a frequent transit line for a bus.
Okay.
So generally with 15 or 20 minute stops in between.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Marsh. Thank you, Chair. I just had a question about the foregone revenue, which may be a key to why this program doesn't exist in other communities. Is that your total foregone in that middle column, property tax from these projects?
So thanks for the question. So Chair Nathanson and Representative Marsh, yes, that's on an annual basis, an estimate, being that some of these are still applications in process. But yes, so the total for the 170 units in 2018 is that 186,000 mark per year.
And if I may follow up, of those numbers then, that's not revenue simply foregone to local government. That includes the school revenue, the full the full property tax payment.
Yes.
So yeah, we should be clear. So we look at those columns that we, the state, are actually picking up a chunk of all of that foregone revenue by replenishing school money that's not being provided on the local level. So we also have a stake in this program on a tangible monetary basis.
Mr. Nelson, you were the first to mention the but-for test. Ms. Van Bockel, you mentioned it also. Can you talk to us a little bit about what that means? Does someone, what sort of audits or oversight do you have? How do you come to the conclusion that you are comfortable that that project would not have happened but for? And have you seen projects change their business plan, for example, to achieve the but for test?
Chairman Nathan, thank you for the question. And I'll be the first to admit that I'm not the manager of this program and into the details, but what I do know is that that was a very central part of the discussion for the city council when there was a moratorium put on the program in 2013. And then we spent about 18 months, 2 years to retool the program. And there was discussions around clawback provisions and the test. And so one of, as I had mentioned previously, and for the record, within the Senate bill record, there's a number of documents related to this program. And so we've made all of the guides and the other materials available as part of that record. But as far as the review panel, they are not only neighbors, so that there's some sense of input from the livability and the neighborhood scale, but there's also six panelists that represent architecture, engineering, finance, and a number of construction and development-related professions, so that they can take a look at the performance that are provided by the business and be able to look at those from the standpoint of what they know in their professions as accurate and transparent way to present a project. And so that's the review, and then ultimately the decision falls to the city council to make the decision. On your last part of the question related to has it changed anything, we do have a project on our riverfront UEB redevelopment, and through the initial process of working with the master developers and putting in front a MUPTI application and an interest in that, it was made pretty clear that the co-location of affordable housing project was not sufficient enough to meet the test and kind of the but-for, and so they were required to bring up their kind of meeting of those requirements in a much more tangible manner. And so it is a dynamic process, and I think that it's the new way that we've kind of put some additional sideboards and guidelines has produced a lot more projects that benefit the community.
Thank you very much for the response. Any other questions? No one else has signed up to testify on 262. Is that correct? Thank you for being here. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 262. We will now move to House Bill 2053A. I'm opening a public hearing. 2053A.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2053A modifies employment and employee compensation programs provisions for the Oregon Business Retention and Expansion Program. That includes enterprise zones, long-term tax incentives for rural enterprise zones, business development income tax exemption, which is also called Oregon Investment Advantage, and Oregon Industrial Site Readiness. Alter some of the metrics for qualification into this program.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Just very quickly for the record, I want to share with the committee that I serve as an enterprise zone manager for several zones and multiple programs here I utilize.
Thank you. First to speak will be Art Fish.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Finley, Vice Chair Marsh, members, honorable members of the House Committee on Revenue. It's a pleasure to be here. My name is Art Fish with Business Oregon. This bill deals with five programs, and I'll give you a little rundown on them. But we hope that with passage of this bill, discussion of these programs will be a lot simpler, okay? They're a little complicated. Actually, they're somewhat variable. We've got two property tax exemptions in there related to enterprise zones, one which is used rather infrequently, but it's a big impact in some rural areas. The extension to 5 years from 3 years, which is very commonly used, involving 50, 60, 70 companies at any given time. It's modestly used across in terms of where it's allowed geographically in terms of Southern Eastern Oregon, the Oregon Investment Advantage and relating to income taxes. And then two programs that are administered through our agency and not really tax programs, but they rely on the personal income tax revenue from employees. What ties these programs together? The five that are in the bill, well, they all have requirements. They all have job requirements, which are not terribly complicated as far as the minimum amount of hiring that must take place. But as far as the application of how much those employees are paid or their compensation can get quite involved now. And that's kind of a product of just differing legislation at differing times, sometimes adding on things over time. Now, one of the programs that you may know of in the property tax realm is the Strategic Investment Program. And I throw that as an example of a program that's not in the bill because it has no hiring or wage requirements as such. Another thing to say, I mean, these programs have other aspects to them. And one that came up at the very, during the work session of the last committee that reviewed this bill was clawbacks. And I should note, these programs do have clawbacks. There's only a few examples in the bill of where those sorts of provisions are brought into the bill. But I'd be happy as well as to answer any questions regarding various aspects of these programs beyond the specific focus.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Again, I'm pretty familiar with these programs. It might be really beneficial for the public if the speaker defined what a clawback is, so we're all have the same definition.
Okay. Chair Nathanson, Representative Smith, members of the committee, I actually do not like to use that term. I think it's a little bit misleading, but I'm sort of quoting the last committee. I refer to it as compliance and enforcement, and it's an important element of these things. We do want accountability. They have different ways of working. And so what I'm talking about is what are the repercussions? I mean, a lot of this is tax policy, so it operates a little bit on the honor system. We're assuming that people, because of the penalties involved, will abide by the law. And by and large, I mean, I just don't, I work with companies and county assessors and our own staff day in, day out, and we work with these companies a lot, and they do get sometimes kicked out of these programs, and they may pay back the taxes or whatnot. So that's I hope that answers the question. And I'd be happy to talk more specifically about those matters. The focus of the bill, however, is with the wage and compensation requirements. And like I say, they're quite variable. In some cases, you include benefits. In some cases, it's just the wages on average or the highest wage or whatever of the employees that are being that are affected by the program. Some cases the timing is different. When do you set that base wage that you use? And then there's programs that use both a wage requirement and a requirement that's based on benefits. Some are compared to they're always compared to the county annual wage, but the definition and how we drag that number out of the employment department data could differ a little. So in a sense, we're trying to align and standardize a great many things. And on the first page of the bill, for example, you will find some definitions that pretty much correspond to BEP and RISIS, the Business Expansion Program, and the Regionally Significant Industrial Site Program, which are the two I mentioned that rely on the personal income tax revenue that's raised to kind of pay, you know, either pay an award or to pay back local jurisdictions that have invested. So we'd use these common definitions for a county state wage based on a certain time and then, you know, go from there. So with that, I just kind of reversed the order a little bit in my written testimony and dropped to sort of the key technical change, as we call it, with respect to the tax incentive. And then I'll loop back maybe and explain a few substantive changes that are being introduced for BEP and RISIS. But with the enterprise zones, including the rather busy extended abatement from 3 to 5 years, as well as the Oregon Investment Advantage, what we're proposing in this bill is to collapse a variety of different permutations and options and differing ways of dealing with wage and compensation. And, you know, what are the problems with the current law? Well, it does complicate communication, marketing. It complicates and confuses some of the data we collect. It makes it harder to make sure we're all talking in the same lingo, as well as some of the compliance and enforcement issues would become much more straightforward if we collapse these various definitions and methods down to primarily a 110% requirement for the affected employees, which are defined not in, you know, they differ because the programs differ, but those affected employees would need to be at 110% of the very current county wage or state. If it's lower, it's only lower effectively in two counties. Well, you can guess which ones. And so that would be a very great simplification. 110% corresponds to the very common requirement of 130% with benefits, which mostly applies in these circumstances. With a very conservative number of taxable income accounting for total compensation based on, you know, these Bureau of Labor Statistic numbers, that taxable income is 84% of their total compensation, throwing out sort of the Social Security and other elements. And that 84% of 130% roughly is 110%. So that's the nature of that change, to really plow through a lot of different things and break them down into a much simpler story by and large for this issue across those tax incentives. I should note one thing. In a lot of the urban zones, primarily Salem, Marion County, for example, and some of the and the Portland area ones, which have gotten quite numerous in the last decade, there actually isn't a requirement in statute for any level of pay. But we would apply the 110%, or the bill would, to all zones equally, but it would allow those urban zones to develop these local conditions as they've done and develop alternatives based on the existing historic methods they've used. And then finally, I'll just circle back around to BEP. With BEP, it's been used about 8 times over the last several years. It is an award that the with a performance agreement that the department makes to a business in, you know, and it has requirements of 50 jobs that meet a very high level of pay, 150% wage to wage, 130%, so that those 50 and whomever else is hired can pay back that award relatively fast based on the personal income taxes that are estimated that those new employees will produce. This bill would reduce the number or allow jobs in rural counties to count twice towards that 50, allowing the bill. That's kind of the major substantive change in the bill, to make BEP an award that has never been used in a rural county, perhaps much more usable in rural areas. And then finally, I would just note with RISIS, which is not a tax or an incentive in any way. It's a reimbursement based on the personal income tax revenues that are, you know, need to be quite hefty quickly to local governments for industrial site readiness. And in that case, the wage level for rural areas would be reduced to 130% as opposed to 150% to make that a little more feasible in those cases. So with that, I think I've said enough. Wish your support for this so that, you know, it isn't quite as elaborate to talk about some of these things in the future. Again, some of the basic hiring requirements are pretty easy to navigate and work with companies to make sure they're meeting them. But with that, I just welcome any questions. I love to do Q&A.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm a chair of the committee. This is the first time I've looked at this legislation, but I have a high level of trust in the gentleman before us. He does a phenomenal job managing these programs, and I think the issue before us in terms of streamlining the conversation makes tremendous sense. And so I would hope that we could continue this conversation.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I just think, thank you.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. It's always a pleasure. Thanks.
Next, we will hear from, why don't you all come up at the same time? Garrett Rosenthal, Jody Weiser, Marcia Kelly.
Nathanson and members of the committee, Jody Weiser speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon. So over the course of several days, a small group of Tax Fairness Oregon people taken a close look at this complex bill submitted by Business Oregon. It covers five different business subsidies, which together will cost $234 million in the next biennium. And that excludes one of the programs which has yet not been deployed. What we found is that in several of the programs, the bill would actually reduce the job numbers and employee wage standards required to qualify. In most cases, it would make it easier in urban areas for businesses and land developers to take advantage of the very substantial tax subsidies the programs offer, thereby increasing Oregon's tax expenditures and diminishing revenues further. There are noteworthy good changes in the bill, but our testimony focuses on the work that is yet to be done. But for instance, there's one program where the job standards that currently have to be met are pay levels when you start building the project. And those pay levels are what is required like 7 years later. And so obviously those are not very good job standards in current law, and it is important that we be looking at what the wage standards are. We totally understand the desire to move to requiring levels of wages rather than wages plus benefits, as is the case in most of the law. It's difficult to verify the amount that benefits cost. And we agree that the current wage benefit requirements of 150% and 130% need to be reduced if you're only looking at wages. And we are actually surprised that the bill doesn't seem to attend to that change for two of the five programs. But the department has testified that wages in traded sector jobs tend to be 84% of the total cost of compensation. Our math says that the new requirements should therefore be 150% would be changed to 126%, and 130% would be changed to 109% of county average wage, not the 115% and 110% that are proposed in the bill. By changing definitions and calculations, these proposed wage requirements would reduce the current wage requirements in some cases and actually expand them in others. But if we're looking for what our common law should be, it should really make good sense. We note that in the bill on page 1, line 24, it defines compensation to mean wages or taxable income. We think wages is actually the word that should be defined there and used throughout the the bill rather than using the easily confused word compensation, which is heretofore meant wages plus benefits. So in my written testimony, I give several examples of places where the law as it current stands and what is proposed would have effect. And I don't want to go through that all with you. You've got it before you. But I think you can see, if you look just at the Section 7 example, that changing from compensation of 150% of county average wage to 110% is quite a difference just here in the urban enterprise zone in Salem. The point is that we have a broad set of tax incentive programs that continue to expand and are diminish our revenues. According to the most recent tax expenditure report, 114 additional standard enterprise projects with at least 3,800 additional jobs are proposed to begin exemption in 2019. A second major issue that we have is that Business Oregon seems to have interpreted bills that you've passed as saying that only a certain number of jobs have to meet the wage requirements. So a bill will say that in an urban area you have to create 50 jobs and they have to pay X amount of money. But it appears that what they're saying is 50 jobs have to meet that requirement, but another 1,000 jobs could exist without meeting the requirement. So with the RISIS program, for instance, Amazon is being spoken of as qualifying for us to divert 50% of the income taxes of the employees to the Port of Portland, because the Port of Portland did acquire the land and put in the infrastructure. And those dollars would be given to the Port of Portland until all of the cost of acquisition and preparation for the site for Amazon's massive distribution center to be paid off. Well, that could take decades to begin with. And the interpretation seems to be that 50 jobs have to pay well, and the other 1,450 jobs can be $15 an hour jobs. Those would be jobs that, unless the person was single, we would be supporting with food stamps and low-cost housing, because they're not livable wage jobs. A third major issue is that Business Oregon frequently states that they don't have authority over 3 and sometimes even 5-year enterprise zone programs, but the bill doesn't ask to give them authority. And when we look at the transparency website, what we see is that a lot of what's being reported doesn't seem to meet what the law says. For instance, if you're supposed to create a job to get a tax exemption for 3 years, why isn't there a new job each time there's an additional exemption for a facility? And in Morrow County, there's $20 million of tax exemption for 3- and 5-year exemptions, but there are no jobs reported at all by the project sponsor. And
Ms. Weiser,
surely there are some jobs.
Ms. Weiser,
there.
I need to make sure that we have time for the other people who want to testify, and we have two more bills. I note that you have submitted all of these comments. And I'm reading them ahead of your saying them. Can you just summarize
the main points. If you look at the written testimony, the last section is the basic amendments that we think that should be considered before we move this bill forward. And we certainly do agree that there are so many different rules for so many different programs that some consistency would really be a valuable change.
Thank you. And I see that you do have 6 specific amendments you're suggesting.
Right.
Thank you.
Do you want to go? Go ahead.
Chair Nathanson and members of the committee, Marsha Kelly for the Oregon Women's Rights Coalition. I have provided a spreadsheet as part of my testimony today, and then I'll speak directly to that. This is a spreadsheet of every tax expenditure that has been authorized since 1991, the year after ballot measure 5 went into existence. And if they can't put it up on the screen, I'll give everybody copies later. Talking about some of the issues for the 5 programs that are here, we talked about the property tax on the long-term rural enterprise zone, but we didn't talk about the income tax. They're all detailed on this sheet, which I'd like to give to you. But I also found that the business expansion and retention program does not seem to be in the tax expenditure, and this is giving money back money. So I would suggest that there would be an amendment that every program in Business Oregon be included in the tax expenditure report. There are some things in the tax expenditure report that are not able to be quantified, and this only covers the tax issues or the tax expenditures that have happened since 1990. And to note, the enterprise zone went in 1985, and so for your edification, it says that there's $139,400,000 in property tax in enterprise zones in the next biennium that would not be collected, and $122 million of shift to other taxpayers. And when you think about the fact that schools are between 40% and 40% of the property tax, that's a lot of classroom money that we would be able to quantify if we didn't have so many enterprise zones, or if we cut people off after they were economically doing well and not continue to give advantages like the Oregon investment advantage. I would have loved, when I had a small business, to be able to not have to pay income tax, as much income tax on the salary of my employees, but there are little details like that that do not happen.
Thank you.
Chair Nathanson, Vice Chairs Findlay and Marsh, who's not here at the moment, members of the committee, pleasure to speak. A lot of the things I'm going to address, my name is Garrett Rosenthal, speaking for Tax Fairness Oregon, and a lot of the points, some of the points will be very similar to what Jody Weiser said, slightly different perspective. Our concerns in this case touch on 3 issues. First of all, the issue having to do with what is a traded sector. Under the older definitions, Amazon probably would not be a traded sector. The new definition is a little bit broader and perhaps overly inclusive. Third, but our major points are, and I'll summarize it because you've heard similar testimony, is, first of all, we have trouble with the state or county average, whichever is lesser, which disadvantages people who are working in the metropolitan region and, to some extent, Clackamas County as well, because it lowers the wage standard for those people. But they're competing for the same housing of the same cost of living as other people. And the Amazon side is a particular note, and it gets to the point that Ms. Weiser made, is the way I read the original intent of the bill passed in 2013 was that it was all the jobs at a particular facility should meet the certain kind of standard, whatever it's 110 or 100. And we agree that it should be consolidated so that it reads wage, because compensation is much harder to measure, and we agree with that. But the way I read the original intent of the bill is that it's all the jobs at that particular facility, and we're not entirely sure how it's interpreted in the Amazon case. But if you have a case where you're paying 50 jobs at an adequate wage and a whole bunch of jobs that are at minimum wage or slightly above the minimum wage at what is not really a family living wage, then we are subsidizing. It's not that we think that that's a bad idea. Any company should do that. But the state should be careful about subsidizing that, because that comes out of other people's monies. That comes out of the state education fund. As you know, 45% approximately of at least some of these, at least property taxes, will come out of the state education fund. So we have to be careful as a state about subsidizing developments that generate jobs for people that then are going to have to rely on other state services. It's sort of, we're sort of, biting our own tail off in a sense. So
The bottom line is we'd need to stick to the original intent and require that the average of all jobs at the facility, not just the top 50 or 25 or 100, are at 150% or whatever the standard must be. And secondly, get rid of the clause of whichever is lesser, any employee working in the metro area should has to comply with those things. So those are our concerns. As our testimony indicates, it's not that we're opposed to the concept of trying to consolidate, but we think there's a little bit more work that needs to be done on this economic development thing. And we do support economic development, but I think the state has to be careful on how it applies its incentives in cases, and it has been a little lax in some cases. I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank
you. Questions for this panel? Thank you. And there's no one else in the room signed up to testify on 2053A. I have a question for you from the perspective of Legislative Revenue Office. Can you would you be able to comment on some of the issues that have been raised on the things that might be potential problems in the way the bill is written, some suggested amendments, or, for example, the issue of traded sector, or what is or is not included in the tax expenditure report? Can you prepare some responses for us?
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Legislative Revenue Office is working on that, and this touches both income taxes and property taxes, so Kyle and I are working in concert, and possibly Caitlin.
Okay.
And some of the issues like the lower of state or county mm-hmm. wages and the conversion of compensation to wage we're looking at, and we'll address the questions that came up today.
Great, thank you very much. I'm closing the public hearing on House Bill 2053A, and I'm opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 162A.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 162A is a bill that was introduced on behalf of the Treasurer, and it's relating to the 529 program, the College Savings Program. And what the bill is doing is it's allowing a personal income taxpayer at the time of when they're filing their personal income taxes to initiate the process to establish an Oregon 529 Higher Education Savings Network account. And it does this by requiring the Department of Revenue to provide a means by which the personal income taxpayer can begin that process to establish that 529 account. So when the individual is filing, they would have a way to begin that process. It wouldn't necessarily set up the 529 account automatically, but could begin the process of setting up that account. And it does require modified statute to allow Department of Revenue to share that information necessary to begin that process as well with Treasury, and it would apply to tax returns filed on or after January 1st, 2021.
Thank you. Ryan Mann.
Good morning, Chair Nathanson, Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Finley, and members of the House Committee on Revenue. My name is Ryan Mann. I serve as Legislative Director at Oregon State Treasury. Treasurer Reed is out of state at a conference today, but he sends his regards, and I will do my best to fill in for him. This is really one of those bills that is so straightforward. I think the summary provided by Mr. Easton is captures it well, but I'll just add a slight bit of context, but also knowing you have a short amount of time. This is part of Treasury's effort to make the three savings programs that we administer easier for people to interact with and making it easier in general for people to save. So Treasury administers three programs as part of our savings network: ABLE for helping people save for the costs associated with disability, Oregon Saves, helping people save for retirement, and the College Savings Plan for education and training after high school. This, of course, relates to that last program. The College Savings Plan has been in existence for about 20 years and has helped Oregonians save over $3 billion for post-secondary education. But as we look at ways we can improve the program, we want to make it easier for more people to save, and that's what this bill is about. One of the barriers we've heard is simply people know that they want to set up account, they plan to do it, but sometimes taking the time to gather the information they need, sitting down, going through the process of setting up the account is enough of a barrier that it gets put off a little bit longer than they would like. And so the thought here is when you're filing your taxes, you've already gathered the information necessary to set up an account. You're in that mindset, simply check a box. And while you're thinking about it, the data transfer happens and everything that we need to set up an account is then available to us to work with the person on finishing up the account setup. After it's been established, they can then fund the account and they're off to the races. And that really summarizes it. Kyle mentioned this would allow for a data transfer between Department of Revenue to Treasury. We worked with the department on a couple technical amendments, one of which was just removing where exactly on the tax form this checkbox had to be, make it easier for them to implement. So with that, I will stop and answer any questions you have.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Reschke.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Mann, what's the line on the tax form say, or what's the proposed line on the tax form going to read? Do you have that, or?
I would need, Chair Nathanson, Representative Reschke, I would need to reference the bill itself, and I don't have that in front of me now.
Okay, I'll take a look at that.
Go ahead. Department of Revenue is in the room. Perhaps they could help with this.
And just the reason for my question, I'm just trying to figure out, is it plain and simple enough to know what you're checking? And second of all, do you know what's being transferred from DOR to Treasury by checking that box?
So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Deanna Mack, Department of Revenue. And Madam Chair and Representative Reschke, to answer your question, we haven't designed exactly what that's going to look like yet. We envision that it'll be a checkbox on the front on the return, saying that we want you to send certain information, so a checkbox similar to one of these checkboxes here, and it'll have our in our forms and instructions information telling them what it is that they're going to be having sent to the department or to the Treasury Department for information. We envision it'll just be contact information, name and address and maybe phone number, so that they can reach out and establish that account, because once they get that account information from their client, I guess, from the taxpayer, they'll be able to open that account. In future years, they'll be able to make direct deposit into those accounts after that initial year. Does that
help?
Thank
you. Yes.
I'm just curious, why not include ABLE accounts on that as well? Is that specific enough that you don't have to motivate those people to open those accounts, or?
Chair Nathanson, Representative Marsh, I think that is, the college savings program has been around longer and we've simply gathered more feedback from folks on the barriers to setting up an account. And so this was in response to that feedback. I would actually need to double check whether or not we may be able to also do this for ABLE accounts under this legislation, because this allows us to work with DOR to set up the process. And given that ABLE and college savings are both under 529, we may be able to do both. Or if this works well for the college savings program, come back and establish it for ABLE as well.
Thank you. Any other questions? And there's no one else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 162. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 162A, opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 165.
Chair Nathanson, members of the committee, Senate Bill 165 requires all employers in Oregon to indicate whether they offer a qualified retirement plan and thus are exempt from offering employees enrollment in the Oregon Retirement Savings Plan. It allows the Department of Revenue to provide this information to the state treasurer, and it takes effect on the 91st day following adjournment. Signee die.
Thank you. Ryan Mann.
Thank you, Chair Nathanson. Vice Chair Marsh, Vice Chair Finley, members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Ryan Mann. I serve as the legislative director at Oregon State Treasury. I think I can be even briefer on this one. This bill is also straightforward. I already provided the background about the savings networks at Treasury. ABLE, the College Savings Plan, and Oregon Saves. This bill is related to Oregon Saves, which is the newest of the programs, of course, created by the legislature in 2015 to help the 1 million Oregon workers who lack the ability to save for retirement through their jobs. Research tells us people are 15 times more likely to save for retirement when they can do it through a payroll deduction at work. And our job at Treasury is to help employers with the process of facilitating this program for their employees. And that's, of course, for employers who are not exempt from the program, which is really what this bill is getting at. But by way of background, as part of our process to help employers facilitate, we've conducted 333 at last check, which was over a week ago, so I'm sure it's a higher number now, 333 one-on-one education sessions with employers and have registered more than 4,100 employers across all 36 counties. And as I mentioned, employers who already offer a retirement plan are exempt from the program. And we're committed to making that exemption process as easy as possible. For the folks who this program isn't about, we don't want this to be a burden on them. And after gathering feedback about the exemption process, the treasurer introduced this bill to add a checkbox to an existing Department of Revenue form that employers already file annually. And employers will simply check the box to indicate whether they offer a qualified retirement plan. And with that information, we'll be able to take them off the list of folks we need to call to register in the program. And currently, we only know if an employer is exempt through a couple different ways, one of which is the employer proactively reaching out and telling us, hey, we're exempt from this program, don't bother us, which some employers have done. Otherwise, our staff has to call through lists of employers and ask to try to determine whether they're exempt or not, or they've found different data sets. Form 5500 is one source where they can try to glean whether someone offers a retirement plan or not and take them off the list. But it's a time-intensive effort for our staff, and we end up calling employers who really don't need to be called because they're exempt from the program. So this we saw as a simple way of helping the employers, helping save our staff time, and taking those folks off the list who don't need to be called about Oregon Saves. And I think that is really all that needs to be said, but I'm happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, John Mullen on behalf of AARP. The mission of AARP about enhancing the quality of life for all of us as we age is so directly tied to the issue of retirement. AARP has been involved with Oregon Saves since its beginning, and working with the Treasurer's Office, and really appreciate that connection. And I just want to underscore something Ryan said, that employees are 15 times more likely to participate when they have a payroll deduction. So I really want to emphasize how much AARP supports the program. And we've also testified on Senate Bill 164 as well as 165. We think these two bills add some important clarity and accountability to the program. Thank you.
Questions for this panel? Thank you both for being here. There's no one else signed up to testify. I'm closing the public hearing on Senate Bill 165. There's no other business before us. We're adjourned.